Okay. We haven't started yet, but we're glad you're here. All right, so picking up again the story, 1519, all of the people that Luther has offended in attacking indulgences are still not satisfied. They haven't yet kind of reached a point of decision on this whole matter. And of course, as we know, this really was just the beginning of the story. So that takes us to this point in 1519 where you have the Leipzig disputation or debate. So this features Martin Luther. I assume he's the guy on the right. And part of the reason why I believe and assume that is because the artist who I know to be Protestant has placed the windows behind Eck, Johann Eck, Luther's opponent, so that the light is landing on Luther's face and shadows are in the face of Eck. It's interesting to pay attention to what the artists do in these depictions of major events in church history. There's a little bit of perspective that even comes through in the way the art is done. The other thing I like to do in class when I put art on the screen, especially those great Baroque paintings of biblical scenes, is it's really, really fun to ridicule them because they almost always depict Jesus and the disciples as though they were, living in Florence or Milan around, AD 1415. And so they're dressed in, Baroque Renaissance clothing, and they're in like buildings with Corinthian style columns and, modern musical instruments. And anyway, it's kind of a nice little diversion in the middle of class to play art critic, which of course I'm not even qualified to do. I'm like at all, but I just like to kind of pretend. I'm not really sure why that's something that I enjoy, but I do. I had a friend who had a summer job as a guard at the Bob Jones Museum and Gallery, where they have a lot of this kind of Baroque art, which is a great job and a terrible job because you get paid to walk around and look at the art, but the problem is you have to stay in like six rooms, and so in 5 minutes you've looked at all the art, and then you have to make sure you aren't asleep when an actual visitor to the gallery comes through. Because the rule was you had to be standing up whenever like there was a visitor in the gallery. That part was hard, but wandering around and critiquing the art, like the amateur that I was lots of fun. Besides, they were paying me to look at it rather than me paying them for the privilege. So that was also cool. So the political situation in Western Europe has dramatically changed here by the time we come to 1519. Emperor Maximilian of the Holy Roman Empire has died. And of course, there's the old joke, which is partially true, that the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor truly an empire. And all of that's partly true, but anyway, it's the political entity of the day, and it is significant whether or not it's Holy Roman or really an emperor in our modern sense, or empire in our modern sense. Well, he's replaced by Charles V. Charles V is already King of Spain. He was elected to be Holy Roman Emperor. Remember, we've been talking all this time about these electors. There were seven votes, right, and all of that stuff. You've got Albrecht and all of it. That's when that matters, okay? The seven electors, or however it exactly worked, they've elected Charles V of Spain. The emperor has, at this point in history, a typically rather loose amount of influence over the various regions under his authority. So the Elector Frederick the Wise is actually a very significant individual himself. It's not like the emperor can absolutely make Frederick the Wise do whatever he wants, although certainly he has some influence. And Charles was a man of immense power. This was unprecedented. In fact, Pope Leo X actually tried to get somebody else to become Holy Roman Emperor. Because with the amount of territory that Charles V already had under his control before he became Holy Roman Emperor, he now becomes the most powerful man in all of Europe. And so this creates a bit of political instability within Europe. It threatens even the power of the church. And Heinze explains this. He says, Charles V was now the most powerful European prince since Charlemagne. But the 19-year-old emperor had his own problems. His great power worried the other rulers of Europe, especially the king of France, Francis I, whose kingdom was surrounded by Habsburg power and who became Charles's implacable enemy and almost continuously was at war with him. In the east, the Ottoman Turks under Suleiman the Magnificent, 1520 to 1566, threatened the border of the empire, crushing the Hungarians at the Battle of Mohacs in 1526 and laying siege to Vienna, of all places, Vienna, in 1529. So for a long time leading up to this point, the Holy Roman Empire has been kind of cushioned from the assaults of the Turks because the Viennese navy kind of keeps control of that very region of the Mediterranean. Now the Viennese are besieged. And so the Holy Roman Empire is starting to feel the pressure here as the Turks are seeking to surge into Europe. The political situation was to have a major effect on the Reformation. The papacy was often more concerned about curtailing the emperor's power than about the Reformation. While Charles's attention was constantly diverted by his political problems so that he was unable to deal effectively with the developing schism in his empire. He also needed the support of the Lutheran princes against the Turks, so he could not afford to alienate them. It's interesting how often war makes the weirdest of bedfellows in political situations. And this is just a reality that happens all the time. I better not chase that interesting rabbit trail. But in the American Revolution, we get some religious freedom out of the fact that the Americans needed Baptists to support them because there were a lot of them in the American frontier. And the Baptists astutely said, well, until you start letting us worship freely in Anglican-controlled territory, forget about us supporting. And so by the time we get to the Constitutional Convention period, the American politicians are willing to make some concessions because they have to, because they depended on all these people for troops. Okay, back to the 16th century. Sorry. Where was I? Oh, okay, that paragraph. So soon after Charles's election, Luther engaged in this Leipzig disputation with Johann Eck. Eck's approach in this debate, and so Cardinal Cajetan was in many ways, you could say he was more of that mythical disinterested academic, you know, the neutral sort of, but he's arguing his view, but it's more or less polite. Eck is different than Cajetan. Eck is out to get Luther. Eck considers Luther to be an enemy. And Eck's approach to this debate was to compare the teachings of Luther with those of John Huss, who had been condemned as heretical by the Council of Constance, which met from 1414 to 1418. And when Luther admitted that he agreed with Huss on the issue of papal authority, Eck sprang his trap. And he managed to provoke Luther to say this, "I assert that a council has sometimes erred and may sometimes err. Nor has a council authority to establish new articles of faith. A council cannot make divine right out of that which by nature is not divine right. Councils have contradicted each other," and they absolutely had. "A simple layman armed with scripture is to be believed above a pope or council without. Neither the church nor the pope can establish articles of faith. These must come from scripture. For the sake of scripture, we should reject pope and council." You can see how Eck has what he wants right here. Because a lot of what's going on behind the scenes now is not just about the fact that Luther messed up a really beautiful backroom deal. But Luther, by implication, implied that the authority of the Pope was limited and subordinate to the authority of Scripture. And Eck recognized that that's the direction where Luther is heading, and he manages to draw this out and get it in explicit, direct, and simple language. Well, this is in Leipzig, though. And as much as that does play to Luther's, to Eck's advantage, Jan Hus is hated in Leipzig for various reasons. He still hasn't managed to convince Frederick the Wise that he ought to condemn Luther. Luther and Frederick have a really remarkable relationship. Frederick is not by any particular means evangelical, although he does allow for Protestantism to develop within his domains. But he's not about to just let the papal powers push him around and tell him what to do with his subject. And so Eck then writes to the Pope and asks him to excommunicate Luther as a heretic. Eck understands something that Albrecht maybe did not. Look, don't send the Pope a letter and just assume that he'll recognize the manifest error. Send him a letter and say, this man is a heretic, you need to condemn him. And so that's what Eck did. Well, this leads to a fascinating period in Luther's life. This is year 1520. That actually shrinks it so it fits. This is just one of our better portraits of Luther, and probably relatively historically accurate as well. So I'm not going to pick on this one for anachronisms like I will some of the paintings of biblical scenes. But of course, the artist does have the advantage of being able to depict, you know, a living person who's sitting in front of him, probably posing for the portrait. That sure helps. Jesus never sat for any of the Renaissance painters, I'm afraid. Meanwhile, Luther, during all of this time, he's become a popular German hero. And this is interesting, too, but there's so many things going on in the Reformation period. As Christians, we like to think that it's all about theology, which as a teacher of theology is just awesome for me. You know, like, hey, like 100-year period, all people are doing is arguing about the Bible, and I get to teach you about it, and here you are listening. That's awesome. But there was a lot more going on than just theology, folks. There was also the fact that there's this rising concept of nationalism, and people are starting to think, hey, this is kind of cool. One of us from Wittenberg is saying, you know, forget it, Pope. And there's this developing concept of, hey, we're a people, and we're independent of Italy to some extent. And so Luther is becoming like the first national hero here and is tremendously popular. Well, during the year of 1520, he was very, very busy. He published 16 treatises, major treatises, and over 100 sermons. Now, think about this a second, right? There are, give or take, 52 Sundays in a year. So, assuming a constant rate, we're talking about 2 sermons a week, which I know one person in the room writes sermons and knows how much work goes into that. 2 is demanding. And especially when you're writing major treatises, 16 of them, on the side. This was a frenetic period of busyness for Luther. And during this time, he is starting to clearly espouse views that would be considered heretical by the Catholic Church. And this is just a selection, again, from Mark Knoll's book, Turning Points, where he gives us a little summary of these major works during this period. These are more important, really, than the 95 Theses. This is where we get to the heart of Luther's new Reformed theology. Although, interestingly, and as I always do, I forgot to bring my copy. It's none of these are the things that were his favorites at his death. I think in the same conversation I told you about last night where he said, oh, what a blabbermouth I am. He also just said, well, you know, if you're going to keep any of it, maybe the one thing you especially should hang on to is my notes on Galatians. And people throughout the ages have remarked on the remarkable, encouraging quality of his commentary on Galatians. And I've heard about it enough that I actually bought it out of the American edition of Luther's Works, which is a huge set, has like, I don't know, 75 or 80 volumes. And the two of them cost me, well, about $50 a pop, because it's an academic kind of thing that not many people are interested in buying. And I've really enjoyed dipping into them, but I haven't been able to read them all the way through. Someday, maybe, I'll get to do that. Okay, 1520, what he's writing then. The remarkable nature, Noel writes, of Luther's literary productivity is shown especially by what he published in 1520. Apart from the distinct value of each work, together they provided much of the bulk that was laid on the table at Worms during the confrontation with Charles V. In 1520 alone, Luther published, besides a flurry of less substantial writings, five major books. His Treatise on Good Works claimed to show how faith in Christ was, strictly speaking, the only good work that God expected from repentant sinners. Moreover, the work of faith was something humans could perform only by grace, because faith itself was a gift from God. Luther's aggressive The Papacy of Rome intimated that the Pope should be called Antichrist, because although he was supposed to be the vicar of Christ, he actually kept people from understanding and heeding the message of the gospel. His address to the Christian nobility of the German nation was a rousing appeal to leaders north of the Alps to throw off the tyranny, economic and political as well as spiritual, that bound them to Rome. His appropriately titled Babylonian Captivity of the Church, I love that title, presented a searching examination of the church's sevenfold system of sacraments. By claiming to find only baptism and the Lord's Supper, and perhaps confession as sacraments authorized by Christ in the New Testament, and by arguing that the Catholic Church's domination of sacramental practice had turned them into works of self-righteousness, Luther threatened the very foundations of Christendom as it had grown up around the sacramental system. The temperature is just getting warmer and warmer and warmer in Luther's works here in 1520. And this one is just really striking. We'll talk some more about his view of the sacraments next time. The perhaps next to confession is really important there, because actually in the Babylonian captivity, I'm going to say this tomorrow, why am I saying it now? Oh well, you actually see a shift. He starts by saying, well, there are three: Lord's Supper, baptism, confession. Or is that what it is? Yeah. And then by the end, he says, no, sorry, changed my mind, there are only two. which is just kind of interesting, you know, along the way in the middle of writing. It's not like he has his word processor and can just go back and find all the references where he mentioned three and change it to two, so it's just there. And you see his theology developing in the middle of writing the book. In contrast to the sharp polemics of these other works, Luther's last major book of 1520, The Freedom of a Christian, was a much more ironic effort to explain how a believer redeemed entirely by the exercise of divine grace would nevertheless naturally be active in doing good works. Luther, with his gift for paradox, put it like this: a Christian is a perfectly free Lord of all, subject to none. A Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all. What a brilliant paradoxical way to capture the nature of genuine gospel freedom. That though we are free in the sense that we are not bound under all of the ritual observances of the Mosaic law, we are yet in another sense subject to serve one another in love. A beautiful paradox that's core, I think, to the gospel message itself, and he captures it in this work on the Christian's freedom in an immensely helpful way. This was designed not so much to carry on his debates and arguments with the Catholic Church, but just to help the people that were left. He's realizing here that there's a big change going on. I need to help people understand how to deal with the fact that I'm saying we are free from that whole sacramental system. I need to give them some kind of positive replacement of, okay, so what about works? Luther is, as you can see, easily charged with being antinomian or against righteous living. And so that's where this paradox comes in to help him. No, there's a place for works, but it's not the way that earns you salvation. It's the natural result of the fact that God has done a work of grace in your heart. Well, obviously, with statements like these, Luther had clearly given up any prospect of reconciliation with Rome. And this reconciliation never came. Before any of these major works had been published, the Pope had already written the papal bull Exsurge Domine, which excommunicated Luther and called him the wild boar from the forest. And you know, we laugh, but what's funny about this is that's actually somewhat true. Luther is blunt, if nothing else. If you ever read him, he doesn't really hide his opinions. He sometimes says things that I think he even regrets. And during 1520, he's writing so many things that one of my sources just mentioned, he's not editing this stuff. So it's just going out there, it's hitting the presses, it's not necessarily stated the best way. It's somewhat appropriate to describe him as a wild boar in the forest, rampaging around, causing all sorts of upheaval and chaos. He was. Well, published in June of 1520, Exsurge Domine gave Luther 60 days to recant. And instead, Luther and his students publicly burned the papal bull, along with works of scholastic theology and copies of canon law, exactly 60 days later on December 10th. By the beginning of the next year, Luther was proclaimed a heretic officially in Rome. So there he is, burning the papal bull. There's a quote in this recorded of why didn't I put it in the notes, of just kind of the words he says as he casts it on the fire. I can't remember even now the gist of it, but everyone's watching. It's a public experience, and certainly captures the attention of the people there in Wittenberg, as all his students are around him and all of his fans. He's a popular individual here in Wittenberg at this point. And they're all excited about this idea. Look at this. Here we are burning a papal proclamation. Of all the things you would do in a medieval world, that's not one that you'd just put on the top of the list. You didn't do that with papal proclamations from, you know, the ex cathedra, all of that stuff. Well, that's what Luther did. Well, that doesn't make him popular with the powers that be, so that leads us to 1521, when it all really matters. Like I complained last night, just because I'm missing 2017 and the 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses is really no big deal, because this is actually probably the year we should celebrate 500 years after of 1521. So in 2021, when no one else remembers, you all can do something special and really celebrate this, because this is where probably for all time, the tremendous pressure that's been building up leads to dramatic and irrevocable change. So this brings us to this momentous event of the Diet of Worms, which I'm told that's the correct German way to pronounce that town name, and it sure helps us, because, of course, if we say it in our English way, it just sounds really funny. Diet of Worms, of all things to pick to eat! But anyway, I don't know my German, so I'm just going on people who I trust who do. And every time I meet someone else who knows German, I kind of will ask them if that's the right way to say it, and I'm always reassured when they say, yeah, you're on the right track. Oh, good. Makes me feel better. Anyway, this painting is probably a little more dramatic than the actual Diet looked like, and the room is apparent, from what I'm told, a little bit smaller But anyway, again, same thing going on with the light. Notice there's the window strategically placed. There's Luther flooded with light. There's Emperor Charles V sitting in utter darkness. I don't know if that was the artist's intent, but it's fun to speculate. All right, so all of this brings us
it
to the...
more or less true.
Well, right, as Protestants, we all do like to kind of make these snide remarks. Yeah. All of this brings us to this momentous event. The church has already proclaimed Luther a heretic, so you're wondering, well, what in the world does the emperor have to do with it? But that's just ecclesiastical sanction. It would be practically meaningless unless Charles V chose to punish Luther. Luther is a subject of Charles V through the fact that he's a subject of Frederick the Wise. So, you know, the Pope can say all he wants, but until the actual sovereign does something about it, nothing really happens to Luther. Luther's safe as long as he stays in Wittenberg. Not a good time for him to book a cruise to Rome, okay? But as long as he stays within the boundaries of Saxony, he's fine. So Charles was reluctant to have Luther appear before him. He has, as we've discussed, other problems on his hands. Yet, nevertheless, he does summon Luther because... not because of the pressure of the Pope, but because Frederick the Wise says, look, Luther needs to be justly condemned or exonerated, and you're the one to do it. So call him in. So under an imperial guarantee of safe conduct, Luther journeys to Worms. He fears death despite the imperial guarantee. He said to his supporters in Erfurt along the way, I have had my Palm Sunday. I wonder whether this pomp is merely a temptation or whether it is also a sign of my impending passion. He's not sure he's coming home. When he first appeared before the emperor on 17th April 1521, he was confronted with a table piled high with copies of his own writings. The pile was so immense that Noel mentions that Charles and his aides, when first they came into the chamber, expressed doubt that any single person could have written so much. Luther was nothing if not prodigious. The question to Luther that day was simple. Will you recant these your writings? And this was perhaps a strategic move. I was just thinking about this today. That there's interview strategists out on the web that you can access, and one of them I was watching, I don't know why, he talked about what he called the flinch, which was a strategic move to get what you want when someone asks you to accept an offer that you don't actually like very much. And basically you just come up with a polite stall and you go, that's interesting, and then that puts pressure back on the person who asks you that question to back off. I wonder if that's perhaps what's going on in Luther's mind. But I suspect that what's really probably going on is something that I very naturally understand. He's an academic. And here's his life's work just laid out on a table. And he's asked to summarize it all in a single sweeping generalization. Can you imagine how frustrating that would be? But have you even read this stuff? Like, don't you know what I'm doing? You probably don't. You just asked me to reject it all. As if I've been wasting my time for the last 20 years of my life as I wrote all this stuff. Or in Luther's case, well, the last one is he wrote most of it, and then the rest of it was not so significant. So I suspect that there's probably just some frustration here as he's running through in his mind all of the things he's written about all of these years and thinking, you want me to make a single assessment of all of that? Like, that's not how we do things in academia, folks. We debate things on their merits. This is not a merit-based evaluation at all. So he asks for one more day to consider his reply because the works on the table were of different kinds. He knows what he's written. He knows it's not all the same kind of stuff. The freedom of the Christian is not the same thing as the Babylonian captivity of the church. Right? And certainly that's a totally different class from the sermons he's written on the scriptures, that, you know, like, everyone's going to want to affirm that. So, well, the emperor wasn't too happy about that, but they gave him his request. And so he faces the emperor one last time on 18th April 1521 at 6 p.m. So the other cool thing about 2021 is you can have a second Reformation holiday in the middle of April. Just keep that in mind. There could be no stalling now. Here's how Noel tells the story. He could delay no longer. The charge came once again. Come then, answer the question of His Majesty, whose kindness you have experienced in seeking a time for thought. Do you wish to defend all your acknowledged books, or to retract some? Luther, who had obviously had considered his reply carefully, responded that his books were of three kinds. Some were works of simple piety that no Christian ruler or church official could possibly want to be withdrawn. A second category were works directed against the papacy and the affairs of the papists, as those who both by their doctrines and very wicked examples have laid waste the Christian world with evil that affects the spirit and the body. Luther did not think anyone would want to defend the evils that those books attacked. But the third kind of writing, Luther conceded, did contain some things that were overly harsh, which he was willing to consider retracting, but on only one very important condition. At this point, Luther laid down his gauntlet. Therefore, I ask, by the mercy of God, may your most supreme majesty, most illustrious lordships, or anyone at all who is able, either high or low, bear witness, expose my errors, overthrowing them by the writings of the prophets and the evangelists. Once I have been taught, I shall be quite ready to renounce every error, and I shall be the first to cast my books into the fire. And so Luther ended his defense. But he had not been explicit enough for the imperial court, and I can just see this. It's so academic, isn't it? Well, there's three kinds. No one would want to refute that. No one would want to deny the errors that I'm dealing with in the other kind. And this other one, well, you know, prove me wrong. He's dealing with administrators, for crying out loud. People who are busy fighting Turks. They're not particularly interested in theological nuances and distinctions. So the emperor's spokesman pressed him again. And the fact that the emperor speaks through a spokesman is important because Charles V does not know German. He prefers French and also knows Latin. And so there's this interpreter that has to kind of go between the two of them. It's kind of interesting. Luther had not really answered the question. Would he recant or not? Deal plainly, not with a horned or three-part ambiguous reply. So Luther then spoke words that augured one of the most momentous changes in the history of Europe and with one of the most significant in the history of the church. Since then, your serene majesty and your lordship seek a simple answer. I will give it in this manner, neither horned nor toothed. Unless I am convinced by the testimony of the scriptures or by clear reason, for I do not trust either in the Pope or in councils alone, since it is well known that they have often erred and contradicted themselves, I am bound by the scriptures I have quoted, and my conscience is captive to the word of God. I cannot and I will not retract anything, since it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience. Over the next several days, Luther met with a delegation led by the Archbishop of Trier. They continued to try to persuade him to recant. He did not. On April 25th, he requested to leave for Wittenberg. Heinze remarks that the course of history may have been changed because a 21-year-old emperor kept his promise of a safe conduct, and Luther was allowed to leave Worms under a new safe conduct. Remarkable, isn't it? It would not be until 26th of May that Charles V officially condemned Luther as a heretic in what is known as the Edict of Worms. But by then, Luther had already been kidnapped by masked horsemen on the road back to Wittenberg. And during this time, Luther disappeared from the public eye. Now, there's a reason kidnapped in scare quotes there. It's because this is where they took him. It's the Wartburg Castle. His kidnappers had been hired by Frederick the Wise. He knew that, you know, imperial safe conducts are nice, but let's face it, Luther is the most hated man in all the Holy Roman Empire right now. And the handwriting is on the wall. And so it'd be just convenient if Luther could just disappear, which he does. So he spends 10 months here in hiding, in disguise. I couldn't track down the source for this, but I've read somewhere that he actually went by a nickname of Junker George. Junker just meant like tradesman, nobody. And this is particularly, it explains something to me. in my own experience, one of our seminary professors, Bob Bell, had a book sabbatical one year. And he was a funny guy. But during that year, he grew a beard, and he called himself Creaker George. And now I finally figured out that he was pretending to be Luther while he wrote his book. Of course, we all knew where he was. He was in the same office he was always in, writing his book. We just didn't bother him because we didn't have him in class. This is a little different. Nobody really knew where Luther was. This is the room where he spent a lot of his time, and during these 10 months, he produced a German translation of the New Testament that was profoundly influential, continues to be read and loved today. Well, at this point, he doesn't really have one.
He's not married yet.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, this is 1521. He gets married. Good question. 1525. There's Katie, actually, right next to that portrait we were looking at earlier. Yeah, and so, yeah, it is a time of forced solitude, but he uses it well. And he uses it for our benefit. Now, I understand there are more recent German translations out there, but they in many ways are kind of building on the initial work that he did. It has this seminal influence on German as a language, much like the King James had on English as well. All right. Just quickly about 1525. So a few years after the Diet of Worms here, his actions just confirm that Luther has now completely swung away from all of his old Catholicism. And in rapid succession, he marries Catherine von Bora, who is herself a former nun. He chastised rebellious peasants for thinking that his interpretation of gospel freedom legitimated political rebellion. And he published a lengthy defense of the bound will against the humanist and biblical scholar Erasmus. These moves showed clearly what Luther felt a Reformed church should look like. It no longer needed a special priestly caste to do the real work of God. It certainly should not be taken as an excuse to disrupt the social order, and it should fully embrace Augustine's understanding of human nature as willfully captive to its own selfishness until God changed the will to honor himself. His career continues. There are many, many things that happen from 1525 to 1546, but the most tumultuous period is now over, and I had this sense as I was preparing this that my time as it is would be slipping away, so we'll pass over that quieter period by just looking at this picture. There was so much that took place. Luther and Katie have many children. They are gifted a tremendously large house that is constantly filled with people, not just their family, but all of Luther's friends. There's this publication that comes out eventually called The Table Talk that's just notes written down of all the stuff they talked about together as they drank Wittenberg beer together. And Luther famously said, well, I slept and drank beer with my friends. The Lord did it all, which is kind of a dismissive statement. He did a few things to cause all of this stuff. But that was Luther. That's how he thought about his own significance, which reminds me of some of the people I've known who've made real impact in the world, that sometimes the way they handle that is they just say, you know what, let's just forget about all I've done. And let's just focus on the fact that God did choose to use me, but it was really him. And that was Luther's attitude for much of what he accomplished. Well, my time is slipping away, but I want to return just for a couple minutes back to that evangelical breakthrough that maybe happened in the tower. We don't know where and we don't know when. But here, let's just focus in on that for just a minute. And the question here is, what exactly has he discovered? He's sensed, he's burdened during this time under the weight of his sin guilt before God, and he's sensed his own inability to satisfy the demands of God's righteousness. So he's wrestling with this question on a very personal, not just a theological level. What must I do to be saved? And when he said, as we read earlier, that he beat importunately, importunately, an old word meaning just constantly, the importunate widow that wouldn't leave the unjust judge alone, he's beating on this text of the Apostle Paul. Which text is he talking about? It's this one, Romans 1, 16 and 17. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous man shall live by faith. And the particularly troublesome part for Luther here is this phrase, the righteousness of God. And just to give you a sense of why this is a problem for him, we have to backtrack and understand the various ways in which you can understand this phrase, righteousness of God. There are actually a number of different shades of meaning or nuance that we can give to this phrase. The first one is we can understand it to refer to the justice of God. And when you do that, it has a negative emphasis. It's focused on punishing sinners. And that is something that does happen. That's probably what's going on in Romans 3, 25 and 26, where it says that God set forth Christ as a propitiation by his blood through faith to demonstrate what? His righteousness. Christ is a demonstration of God's righteousness in that he is a propitiation for God's wrath. Well, that's definitely this justice sense of the term. And this was the traditional view of what was going on here in Romans 1:17. In the gospel that Paul's not ashamed of, and Paul is actually, frankly, quite excited about in verse 16, because of the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, Jew first and also to the Greek, in that gospel, we find the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. So as Luther reads it, he reads, for in the gospel, we find God's justice revealed from faith to faith, the fact that God's going to punish sinners. And Luther is stumped. Why would Paul be so excited about that? Shouldn't he be just like dismayed like I am, that I can't reach the standard necessary to be justified in God's sight? Well, that leads us to some other ways of explaining the phrase. Another one that is out there is that you can understand this is referring to the faithfulness of God, which is, we understand, is one of God's attributes. God's righteousness, then, is a positive emphasis on the fact that God is righteous. He fulfills all of his promises that he has made to his people throughout the Old Testament. The righteousness of God, in this sense, is his faithfulness to fulfill and carry out his promises to his people. Okay? That's a legitimate sense of this phrase, God's righteousness. A little bit difficult to make it fit in with what Paul's saying here, but you can kind of see how it might kind of work. But what Luther eventually settles on is what I've got here as view number three. That is the status that is given by God. And in this sense, righteousness is described or understood as an achievement that God has made. He has granted to his people, both Jew and Greek, by faith, right standing. Luther calls this alien righteousness, which we translate out into a righteousness not our own. And so both views, 2 and 3, are something that have a lot to commend them. This is the view Luther eventually comes to in his tower experience, it seems. He's seeing that this text is now describing this alien righteousness, this status given to us by God through grace. And so this is where Luther turns the corner. And it seems that, and certainly this theme of alien righteousness is huge in Luther's writings about the gospel of grace as it goes on in his life. Now, I've told you that this is still a debated phrase. And just to give you a hint of it, John Stott writes in his commentary regarding view 2 and view 3, You know, they have so much going for them. He says, I've never been able to see why we have to choose between view two, the faithfulness of God to his promises, and view three, an achievement, this alien righteousness that God grants to us on our account. And so then John Stott argues for actually what really is a fourth view. And this is interesting. And there's, I don't have time to go into what's going on, all the implications of this one. But this fourth view sees the phrase righteousness of God as referring to God's act of putting people in the right. And so here the emphasis is not just on this achievement that is finished, but on an ongoing divine activity that in some sense is not yet fully completed. And this is fully understood in an eschatological sense, that God is still at work to perform his righteousness, to put his people in the right, and there's a sense in which he has not yet completed that. He's not yet fulfilled all of his promises to Israel, and certainly he's not yet completed that work in yours and my life, has he?
So Stott is using number four as justification, sanctification, glorification, where Luther sees it, justification.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And actually, I should... I'm glad you asked that question. I should mention this language that I have in quotes here comes from this footnote up here that you might have missed, and that's Douglas Moo, who's written renowned commentaries on the Book of Romans. That the phrase "God's act of putting people in the right" is Moo's phrase, but in Stott's commentary, he's, for, as far as I can tell, arguing for basically the same idea, and I find that idea kind of attractive. And basically, if that's correct, what that means is in Romans 1, 16 and 17, you've got views 2, 3, and 4 kind of all going on at the same time, which is why the commentators have been stumped for so long. That to me is just a beautiful thing, that God is still at work to fulfill all of his promises to his people. And that one of the ways that we see this take place is in the fact that he justifies us and grants us this standing that we don't deserve. And I'm so glad Luther figured that out and gave that back to us. Just think of all of the centuries that people couldn't understand this text. And of course, they didn't have opportunity to access it like you and I do. I mean, look at that. I just copied and pasted it into a document. Luther would have killed for this kind of facility. Yeah. You know, if he knew like what we're doing to all like his, you know, he'd think, oh, what a blabbermouth I am, and look, you just compressed it onto a USB stick. Yeah. Like, oh, you know. But all of these people who didn't have access to the text, but even when they did, they didn't have access to this truth. What a glorious reality to have all of this just so easily available to us. It's, you know, we just kind of assume when we think about the gospel that justification is something we receive by faith. It's a gift of God, not of works, lest any of us should boast. And we can just see how these texts harmonize together, and we just rejoice in that. And Luther had to risk his life and struggle for years to come to that understanding, and we just stand on his shoulders and say, thank you. Oh, praise God that this happened. And God, through controversy, is going to bring us many more gifted men who will help us to better know his mind. There's so much more we could do about Luther's doctrine of justification. I ran out of time to even write up everything I wanted to in my notes, so I've just got these like cheat notes to myself. Go to this page in this book and this page in this book and read you all this glorious stuff. But here I am out of time. So we'll do one more thing that's fun. You know, one of the things I haven't been able to mention is that Luther was not just a debater and a theologian. He loved music. In fact, as a student, he got his student income by playing on the streets in Erfurt. And so he wrote all these great hymns. Of course, The Mighty Fortress is the best known of all of these. He wrote many others that have not survived. And just a few weeks ago, a fellow who used to teach at the school where I went, who composes, released a beautiful new choral arrangement of this. and it's just been on the internet for a couple weeks. So I'm assuming many of you haven't heard it, and I just wanted to take this opportunity to share it with you. So it's right there on the blog post. You can go and listen to this all you want. I've actually been listening to it every day for the last couple weeks, but I've got reason to be interested in this stuff. Now you know why I can listen to that over and over again. Did any of you catch anything in there that you thought surprising? There are little nuggets hidden in there. Nobody? Yeah. After working through his theology, you just see it exploding out of that song. One of the things I love about this arrangement actually is right there at the beginning and at the end, and he explicitly, Dan Forrest said he put it in there on purpose. But in the percussion, there's a hammer nailing the theses to the door. And every time I listen to it, I find it popping up in new places. I was talking to my wife about it, and she says, yeah, well, any of these really great compositions, it's like a novel. You got to keep reading it to find all the new little things hidden in there. I found a new spot tonight where there was the hammer. So anyway, you can listen to this every day for the next couple days and try to find them yourself. I love it. It's download it, stick it on your phone. What a wonderful privilege it is to have the contributions of Luther. All right. Well, we'll see you tomorrow night. Thank you so much.